it will control their circular polarization. In other words, depending on the polarity of a magnet in the presence of an electromagnetic wave, will, depending on the position of the magnet, will either cause to circularly polarize in the, like a right hand or a left hand polarization, circular polarization. That's what magnets do to electromagnetic waves. Now, another thing, as far as electromagnetic waves being affected, it's basically a polarization effect in a vacuum, Wesley. KC2QIQ, and back over to you, Dick.
Hold on now. That gyrotropic effect occurs inside of the Yig material. Are you sure that I can make a clockwise wave or a counterclockwise wave in free space, in a vacuum, respond to a magnet? Are you sure about that one, Glenn? Go ahead.
Glenn, before you pick up, I just need your help a bit more. What it says is that that deflection will be at plus or minus 5 degrees. Would you please repeat again, because I didn't understand that part from all of you. I'm sorry. Glenn, pick up.
Well, here again, Dick, you know, point of origin is always important. In other words, if you've got a beginning of a substrate to the end of the substrate, the ground plane has to be defined on one point with respect to the end. So in other words, yes, you have to have some point of reference in free space to determine polarity. So if you have a material against a magnet, you have to run, obviously, some kind of a substrate or a, you know, some kind of a, you know, something across it, as in the case of a circulator. But there again, also in the other case, around the material itself, so that you have a point of reference.
Okay. I'm not completely in agreement with what you just said. Let me try this on you. I'm transmitting a clockwise circular polarized wave by the IEEE definition. I've launched that wave to the north from where I stand. I've just pointed my antenna to the north, and I've launched a clockwise wave. And you and I could make measurements and say, yes, yea, verily, that is a clockwise wave. If I did that in free space, and there's no local ground plane reference, no Earth nearby, I'm halfway between the Earth and the Moon, couldn't I still call that a clockwise wave, even though I have no local point of reference? Over to you, Glenn.
It's an ambiguity, isn't it? Okay, because how are you going to determine it? Unless you put something in its way to determine what its polarization is. QSL?
Okay. The wave is in free space. The wave is propagating. You and I could make some measurements in free space and say it is propagating from point A to point B. I've defined point A in free space. I've defined point B. And I've done a bunch of experiments, and I say, yes, that wave is conveying electromagnetic energy, and it appears to be propagating from point A to point B. And in that propagation, I could determine whether or not it's clockwise or counterclockwise, even though I have no other local frame of reference. That the word clockwise doesn't need a local reference. I'll admit that the word horizontal versus the word vertical needs some point of reference. But clockwise versus counterclockwise, I could send that wave out into free space to an extraterrestrial intelligence, and as long as they understand my definition, once that wave arrives at their solar system and hits their planet, they could say, yes, by the IEEE standard, that is a clockwise wave, even though I don't have any knowledge of the reference he used when he transmitted it. Over to you, Glenn.
Oh, that's absolutely correct. But now the next question is, can you change it in a vacuum between the source to the other? I think that's what your real question is, isn't it?
Okay. It's reasonably well known that any electromagnetic wave, clockwise or counterclockwise, after one single bounce of reflection, will reverse. So that clockwise wave, all I've got to do is bounce it against a smooth metallic surface, and what bounces off is now counterclockwise. Over to you, Glenn.
Oh, agreed. But now we're talking about in a vacuum. Now the thing is, what could we do that could actually change that polarization in between? Isn't that the question?
Okay, if I keep the medium as a vacuum, I'm not entering some crazy crystal that's got birefringent characteristic to it. If I'm keeping everything a vacuum, and I'm not going to bounce it off a metallic surface or the equivalent, I could also bounce it off a dielectric surface, and a certain amount goes through and a certain amount bounces. But if I'm not bouncing it off some other medium, whether it be dielectric or conducting medium, I don't think there's anything you can do in free space that will change clockwise to counterclockwise. I don't think you can change clockwise to linear. I don't think you can change linear to clockwise. I don't think you can do that with a magnetic field. I think that wave does not see magnetic field. If the wave is now going through a plasma, or if it's going through gyrotropic material, like ferrite material, like a YIG material, yes, I can do all kinds of fancy things. I can also do all kinds of fancy things by putting it into one of these exotic crystals. But in free space, that pointing vector and that sense of polarization, I think, is a very stiff vector that is very difficult to modify. Do you believe you know of a way to modify it, Glenn? Go ahead.
Well, you said the answer right there, because, and that's what I was basically saying before, is that if you have a magnet in space and it's in the path that you're, you know, in the transmission path of that electromagnetic wave, and you block it, that becomes the new medium in between. QSL?
Well, to me, a magnet is usually a metallic object, and if I put a metallic object in the path, I'm doing all kinds of disturbance. Let's assume now that two planets a long distance away, by some means, created a magnetic field in this region. I've got completely high vacuum free space, but there is a local magnetic field that came from something very far away. So it's not part of the experiment, so to speak. But there's a local magnetic field, and my clockwise circular polarized microwave signal is propagating through the free space that has the local magnetic field. Without there being some kind of a plasma-like material or crystal-like material in the area that signal is propagating through, I think that signal will completely ignore the magnetic field. I hope you can hear me over that sound. Over to you, Glenn.
Well, there's also the issue of bias, right? In other words, if we had a static field, and now we're talking about a static field, and so in other words, the electromagnetic wave already has a characteristic to it. Now, is it going to affect it? Yeah, it's going to, because it's an electromagnetic field itself. Now, what exact effect? You'd have to look at each parameter of that electromagnetic wave, you know, X, Y, Z parameter, and then look at the polarity of the intersecting electromagnetic field. So if you had a right, let's see, I'm trying to remember which way does that go, because you have right-hand rule to an electromagnetic field that's static. Now, if you were to take an electromagnetic wave, you would have to intersect that. Yeah, see, yeah, there is a position, Dick, where it will modify it. KC2, QIQ.
Glenn, you might be talking about the Zeeman effect, Zeeman, I think it is. The radio astronomers measure remotely the presence of an electromagnetic field in an emitting nebula. When there is material that's being locally excited by a sun, a supernova, whatever, if there's real material that is emitting, and you can pick up that emission with your radio telescope, and if that emission of that material is in the presence of a magnetic field, The Zeeman effect means that the single line of normal emission becomes two slightly displaced lines. That's what the Zeeman effect is. So in the presence of a plasma-like material and the Zeeman effect, the magnetic field does something. But if I've got a magnetic field, if I've got an electromagnetic wave, circular polarized wave, which is very rapidly going from positive to negative in E field polarity and H field polarity, are you going to tell me that I'm going to delay, in order to make clockwise into counterclockwise, I have to have a different rate of propagation of the horizontal portion versus the vertical portion? I'd have to delay one by half wave compared to the other. I can't, in a hard vacuum, change the velocity of propagation just because you put a magnetic field there. Therefore, I can't change clockwise to counterclockwise if it's propagating through a hard vacuum, and I'll give you as strong a magnetic field as you like. I don't think that can do it. Over to you, Glenn.
Yeah, I would have to agree with that, Dick. Like you're saying, in other words, you need something for the, for the static field, because it's going to have a bias effect on it, but it's not going to change the polarity. That's correct, yeah, no matter what direction it's in. Yeah, because the circular polarization is already defined, and it would shift it, it might steer it, but it shouldn't change the polarity, you're right, KC2, QIQ.
Okay, if it can't change the horizontal versus the vertical component, or the slant 45 right versus the slant 45 left, that's what's required to reverse clockwise into counterclockwise. If it can't do that, then how can a magnetic field even steer an electromagnetic wave in free space? Can it be done with an extremely strong gravity field, obvious by the fact that we've seen gravity lensing? Yes, I'm going to accept that one. Gravity, yes. Magnetic field, I don't think so. I don't think you can steer a electromagnetic wave that is propagating in pure, free, hard vacuum space with nothing but a magnetic field. I don't think you can steer that wave. Over to you, Glenn.
I think it does, Dick, because it depends on the length of the magnetic field and the intensity. So in other words, depending on where it is, it will track or start to follow the magnetic field. There'll be some addition and subtractions to that static field. It will have an effect on it.
In the case of the electrons that move down the center of a traveling wave tube, those are really small charged particles. A moving charged particle in the presence of a magnetic field does experience a transverse force. I'm going to give you that. Yes, an electromagnetic wave consists of an E field and an H field, but they are not made of charged particles. That electromagnetic wave has no electrons that are part of it. There's no charged particles. Therefore, I don't think you can steer it with a magnetic wave, a magnetic field. Over to you, Glenn.
Yeah, but I guess the point that I'm making, Dick, is that if it has already a displacement, an E and H displacement as an electromagnetic wave, and it's got a polarity, and now you take another static field that also has a displacement. And granted, it's not moving; it's static, and it goes through it. It's going to have an effect on it, but I'm not sure just what it is just yet. I'd have to sit down and really think about that one because I'm really not sure. But I think it's going to have some effect on it.
You said it's got a displacement, an E displacement and an H displacement. I think you mean it's got an E direction and it's got an H direction. If I talk about a linear polarized wave, to make things simple. But that polarity of that E field direction is reversing at an extremely high rate. Your magnetic field is a steady state thing. The the electromagnetic wave only exists if the H field is changing. The H field changing makes an E field. You could reverse it and say the E field changing makes an H field, but where did the E field come from if it doesn't consist of electrical charge particles? You can see why I'm thinking that the real transmission out of an antenna starts off as a magnetic wave, a oscillating magnetic wave. So it is changing polarity of magnetic field at an extremely rapid rate. And along comes your steady state magnetic field, which is not changing. I think there is absolutely no effect. And here's what makes me think that. I can have a wave going from north to south, going through your medium, your hard vacuum. Make the electromagnetic wave as strong as you like. Make the frequency anything you like. I produce another wave that goes directly at right angles to it, from east to west. No matter how strong you make either of those waves, they have absolutely no interaction. They propagate directly through each other. That's going on in the air above you right now with all of those broadcast stations. All of those waves going through that air have absolutely no reaction with each other, no matter how strong they are. As long as you don't arc over the air and make it a nonlinear medium, do it in a vacuum where you can't even arc it over, they are thoroughly, they ignore each other.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Each individual wave completely ignores the other wave. So if a dynamic wave has no effect, how in the world is your static wave of magnetic field going to do anything to that electromagnetic dynamic wave? Over to you, Glenn.
Well, I think where the problem comes in and where it's going to have an effect is because something has to be generating a static electromagnetic field that's going to generate a north and a south. So it's going to have to either be a coil, a piece of magnetic material. So there is a mass involved here, and there is going to be some electrons and other things available to it. So there's going to be a mass associated to it. So will it have some steering associated to the mass associated to that field? Because you can't have the electromagnetic wave, it doesn't require a mass. It can run through a vacuum. But every time you're talking about a static field, there is going to be a mass associated to it because it's going to be the obvious generator that's generating it, either the magnet itself or whatever. So there will be an interreaction between that field mass and the electromagnetic wave. So if there's obviously a magnet or a coil or something in the way, it's going to either absorb or deflect or steer or have some effect or detect the electromagnetic wave in its presence, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I'm now partially agreeing with you. There's something in space called the magnetar. In other words, you can have a black hole-like or a very massive-like star that, because of the way it formed, can have an extremely strong magnetic field. And that magnetic field, if the star is rotating, it may be a rapidly rotating magnetic field. But a magnetic star can make an extremely strong magnetic field, and here you and I sit a million miles away from it, literally, and in our piece of space, we can detect an extremely strong local magnetic field. And now my electromagnetic wave going through that chunk of vacuum is not going to see the magnetic field, but it is going to see the gravity of that very massive star that created it. And now the interaction of gravity and a electromagnetic wave, I'm going to give you that gravity lensing. So the photons that you could say exist in that electromagnetic wave, I'm beginning to believe they're not thoroughly massless because they create the photoelectric effect. There's something called a solar sail, and you get this gravity lensing. So they seem to have a small amount of mass. And yes, the gravity of that star can give you some deflection. But the magnetic field itself, I don't think, has the ability to change polarity, to change direction of arrival, direction of travel. I don't think it can steer the wave. I don't think it can delay or advance the wave. I don't think it can change polarity. So magnetic field, a steady state magnetic field, or a dynamic magnetic field, is not going to affect my wave once it's been created and once it's propagating in free space. KC2QIQ, K2RIW, with a bunch of opinions. I'm not really solid on all of this.
Trust me, Dick, neither am I. But I do have an interesting one for you now, too. Think about this one along the same lines. If you have a magnet in space and it's generating this electromagnetic static, you know, field, and then, of course, an electromagnetic wave runs through it, we can kind of suggest that there's going to be some interreaction there because of that mass and that electromagnetic wave, field that's static. So there's going to be something going on with there. And there's a disturbance, at least, this way of putting it. Mm. But now if I had a non-metallic piece of material in between, so in other words, something that's almost like dielectric properties, and the electromagnetic wave goes by it, that's where we select the material so that it's not affected by the frequency of that electromagnetic wave, I don't think we're going to see any kind of steering or any effects at all associated to its gravity, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
And you seem to be describing a massless material. If the material has mass, then it has a certain amount of gravity lensing capability, I think. You're also describing a material that's not affecting the wave, which implies that it's got a dielectric constant of unity. So you've got this substance that has no mass, it has a dielectric constant of unity, which is equivalent to free space. So you've got the stuff you call material, but it acts like free space, like a hard vacuum, and it's got no mass. How do you know the material is there, Glenn? Go ahead.
No, that's not along those lines. No, it's generally, there's electromagnetic waves at certain frequencies bypass right through certain materials. Like, you can take certain plastics, but if you put an Echosorb in between it, it's going to absorb it. I mean, they're going to have a different effect depending on the material. But let's say if I just take, like, a sheet of plastic and say like a VHF electromagnetic wave, it's not going to really have much of an effect on it. It's going to basically pass right by it and ignore it completely. And it's going to have mass, and I don't think you're going to see any lensing around a chunk of, say, plastic in space.
Mr. Koch, K-O-C-H, invented an antenna that does just that. He took a block of plastic, and in one of his embodiments, he made it in the shape of a magnifying glass. And he directs an electromagnetic wave through a microwave electromagnetic wave, and it will focus. He puts that lens out in front of a horn, and he increases the gain of a horn. So your piece of plastic, because it is a material of finite density, and it therefore has a certain dielectric constant, the velocity of propagation is less than unity when it goes through that material. And if I shape the material correctly, I can do beautiful focusing with it. Mr. Koch did that way back before World War II. Over to you, Glenn.
Well, I have to stand corrected on that one, then, because I'm not familiar with that experiment at all, that the dielectrics actually shape electromagnetic waves. But I'd be interested in actually looking that up. How do you spell that, Dick?
K-O-C-H is the man's name. If you look at the Radiation Laboratory Series book, a silver called Microwave Antennas, the Koch antenna is in there, and he's got various variations of it. By the way, you'll admit that an electromagnetic wave, whether I do it at 60 hertz, 60 megahertz, 60 gigahertz, 60 terahertz, 10 to the 14 hertz, all I've done is change the frequency. The frequency that you and I call optical light goes through a magnifying glass and gets focused. If I'm willing to make the magnifying glass larger, and I'm willing to make the frequency a little bit lower, why can't I get the exact same effect? Is there some magic frequency where it suddenly stops happening? Of course not. You had the raw data in your head to look at it that way, in my opinion, Glenn. Just haven't had some crazy person come challenge you in this particular way. KT2QIQ, K2LIW.
Well, as I said, Dick, this is not really my area of expertise in this area. I mean, you know, I know mostly, you know, a lot of the basics of this. But, you know, here again, like you're saying, you know, this is something I got to really start looking into now because, you know, the electromagnetic waves and their effects on different materials, you know, that's definitely something else I got to look more into. Because that's not something that is classical stuff I learned back in school, that's for sure. But, yeah, the you know, certainly the magnetic effects, you know, I definitely saw that. But now, what is the effect difference on the dielectric materials on electromagnetic waves? Because I know, like, certainly, like you're saying, the plasma effects, I'm, you know, pretty aware of most of those, and gases, you know, but there again, the effects of certain gases and other things are, and their effects are way different with frequency as well, so... Frequency does have an effect on some of this stuff, you know, and, you know, the results are definitely different.
Yeah, I'm going to admit that if you take a piece of crown glass, you take a piece of flint glass, you take a piece of polycarbonate plastic, you take a piece of plexiglass, Lexan, you take any of these materials, and as you sweep them literally DC to cosmic rays, you're going to see dips and valleys and variations, very slow variations in general, of the dielectric constant. So now, when that wave gets down to shaking the individual molecules of that material, frequency matters a little bit, so that that piece of polyethylene that's inside of your piece of RG8U coax cable, it has a very slightly different velocity factor at 60 hertz versus 6 gigahertz. And that can be measured. And that's called dispersion effect. So materials do slowly change, most of the time slowly, as they change frequency. But it's not a resonance phenomenon per se, with rare exception. So it does change a little bit. But I can now take your plastic lens on a Koch antenna, which is focusing my microwave wave. And by the way, there's a whole series of microwave antennas where you put a chunk of plastic in front of the horn, and it's called a lens. And they do lensing. They do, let me drop. They do intentional focusing and defocusing concentrating and dispersing, and they bend the wave in all kinds of crazy ways, change polarization at times by having a birefringent material. In other words, you can have a material, like certain kinds of crystals, will up and down have one dielectric constant, and left and right have a different dielectric constant. You propagate your wave through the right number of wavelengths of that material, and because it's delaying the horizontal component differently than the vertical component, I can make clockwise into linear, into counterclockwise, into vertical by having the right amount of that birefringent material. So dielectric constant is a volumetric phenomena on certain kinds of crystals. But if I take any of those crystals, which have this crazy dielectric constant that can modify my wave, it can steer the wave, and it can change its polarity in the crystal, if I now put a strong magnetic field in the crystal at the exact same time, I don't think a steady-state magnetic field will have any effect, at least not to the first order. I don't think it's going to have any effect. So I think an electromagnetic wave in free space ignores a steady-state magnetic field, no matter how strong that magnetic field is. The method by which you created the magnetic field, the mass that you use, yes, that mass is going to do something. But the magnetic field itself, I think the wave ignores it. Over to you, Glenn, K2LIW.
Yeah, I see your point on this one, because, yeah, dielectric constant will have a delay effect on electromagnetic waves. That's clear. So certainly if you have dielectric constant, in the path of the electromagnetic wave, there's delay. So that's clear. But now let's say if we had something with dielectric constant and we put an electromagnetic field, just a static field through the dielectric now, would that have an additional effect? I'm not sure. I think I'm going to bow out for now, Dick. K2RFW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, we're very slowly getting down to the basics here. And by the way, once you know the dielectric constant, you take the square root of it, divide it into 1, and now you know the velocity of propagation. 1 over the square root of E, where E is the dielectric constant, gives you the velocity factor. In fact, when you measure dielectric constant, or when you measure refractive index of a material, you really are measuring velocity factor. They relate back and forth very nicely. So, velocity factor, and what was the other thing I just called it now? Refractive index. It's all dielectric constant, as I see it. It's really different names for the same phenomenon. And by definition, when your wave goes through a more dense material than a vacuum, it's got to slow down. That wave goes a little bit slower through air than it does through a vacuum. It goes quite a bit slower through plastic. And once you can slow it down, I can now tilt the plastic and steer it. I can shape the plastic, and I can focus it. I can make a lens. And I can make every one of your optical lenses that you've ever seen, I can make an equivalent of them in microwaves. And lots of smart people have done it, and they work like a charm. I've personally used a few of those. I think we've gone late enough. We haven't gotten to the bottom of this.
I have one more question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Actually, two. Does it mean that when you go through the plastic, you're losing energy as well as the speed? How much of the speed will slow down? If we're talking about theoretical speed decrease. And also, the origination of the strong force, where the strong force is coming from. Back to you.
Every piece of plastic has both a dielectric constant and a loss tangent. If I'm smart enough to use a really high quality piece of plastic, like Teflon, where the loss tangent is 0004 or is a 0002, it's a very small number. Yet the dielectric constant of Teflon is something like 2.1. A wave traveling through Teflon, a microwave, a radio wave traveling through Teflon, travels at 69% of the speed of light. That wave must slow down when it enters the Teflon. And you're saying that's a loss of energy. However, when it comes back out of the Teflon, it speeds up again and goes right back to the same magnitude it was before and the same velocity it was before. It lost no energy going through the Teflon. Now, there's a catch. You know that all your lenses on high-quality binoculars and telescopes have a coating. A coating represents a quarter-wave coupling plate. That's so that the reflection you get off the front surface doesn't get a chance to happen. You want all the energy to propagate into that lens. So as long as the lens is properly coated, and I can do the same thing with that chunk of a Teflon, as long as you give me a quarter-wave coupling plate so that I can stop the reflection from happening at the forward surface of the Teflon, and I do the same thing at the back surface of the Teflon, then every bit of the energy goes into the Teflon, even though it's propagating slower, and every bit of it comes back out, and it jumps back up to the high speed.
How much we can slow down?
That's strictly a function of what is your dielectric constant. There are ceramic materials that have a dielectric constant of 100, which means the wave goes through that dielectric material. It's called barium tetratitanate, and I've used that material. Barium tetratitanate has a dielectric constant of 100. the wave goes through that material 10 times slower. It travels at 10% the speed of light through that material. And as long as you use the right kind of a coupling plate going in and coming back out, you get all of your energy back out again. You're about to ask me what in the world happened inside of the material. In order to keep the same amount of energy, even though it's moving slower. And I'm not quite sure what, I think the relationship between the E field and the H field got disturbed. The material doesn't have 377 ohms of impedance. It's got some other impedance. So, by the same token, I can take your 50 ohm cable coming out of your signal generator. I can use the right kind of an impedance tapering device. Let me drop. Where I bring your transmission line, your 50-ohm transmission line, down to 25 ohms. And if I do the right kind of impedance matching, all of the energy is in the 25-ohm cable. The 25-ohm cable has 70% of the voltage, but 133% of the current. The product is the same amount of energy, but I've disturbed the E to I relationship. I've kept the energy the same, but the E to I, the voltage to current relationship got disturbed. That's what 50 ohms means, 25 ohms. And then when I convert it back out to 50 ohms, I get my same voltage, my same power right back again, as long as I've done it with the right kind of materials.
What about the thickness of the material?
The sheet of Teflon that's being acting as a lens usually is a number of wavelengths thick. You're about to ask me, can I do focusing if it's only an eighth of a wavelength thick? And I don't think I can do very much. To really do focusing of a real dielectric lens, I need material most of the time that is multiple wavelengths thick. Although you could build a Fresnel lens, a stepped lens, and they have done that at microwaves. The Fresnel lens, the stepped lens that you've seen in optical lensing, you've seen it, for instance, on a lighthouse. They've done that in radio waves, and it works like a charm. Over to you, Wesley.
Okay, I was about to ask you about it. Now, you have the material that is absolutely thick, but still is representing the particular wavelength just in the large number. How much then we would be able to speed to slow down the speed? That's the first question. The second question that I repeat, I'm not asking how the theory of the strong field was created, but where the strong field is coming from, how it originates, how it's being created. These two questions, and to agree.
I think Nassim is shaking everybody up because he's saying the strong field is a fudge factor. They invented a name to explain an observed phenomena. They don't really know if the strong field exists. They know that those two protons are repelling each other like the hammers of hell. They don't want to be close to each other. If you try to take two protons and push them together as close as they have to be inside of a nucleus of an atom, you have to supply a tremendous amount of force to do that. You've got to work real hard to do that. And so, in order for them to stay together in that nucleus, and they know that they're doing that, they invented a fudge factor. A cosmological constant, if you like, to put it in Einstein words. And they called it the strong force to explain that something is holding them together. But Nassim is saying you didn't have to do that. He has an alternate explanation, and you don't need a strong force.
Well, he says that we can treat the strong gravity as the strong force. I didn't say it properly. The attraction, gravitational attraction between two protons can accommodate nuclear and quark, and we can say that we can treat the strong gravity as a strong force, but you...
I'm not sure I've got the right interpretation, but I think what he's saying is that the true proton has a significant amount of mass, but it is an extremely small diameter particle.
And it has the place for nucleon and the quark confinement.
Now that's the next step. But before we go to sub-proton size, the proton itself, I think he is saying it is so small that you can put two of them so close together that the gravity will hold them in a circular orbit around each other. That's what I think he's saying.
I'm going to give you the example. In 1933, I forget who was the scientist, but he was trying to push two plates together to very, very, very close space. And then over time, they stick together. But the problem was technological. They weren't able to make the plates with the accuracy of 1 micron at that time. So this experiment was carried on in 50s, and it was actually proving the fact. Back to you.
Yeah, I think they need a flatness that's greater than a micron. I think it's got to be flatness of better than a nanometer. I think if you get flatness of better than a nanometer and a pair of them, and if you put them together with enough force, they will bond. And I've seen that effect. I've heard about that effect.
Micrometer.
I'm amazed that a micrometer, well, and little portions of that micrometer were smooth enough that portions of it that were down to the nanometer size, and they managed to fuse.
That's pretty good.
So you think it wasn't just the hills fusing. You think that the whole thing was fusing with only 1 micrometer of flatness?
That is correct. It proves the point of the Nassim theory. So when I analyzed it further, and I was analyzing that with the graphs, I was just amazed that the Riemann space curve was completely in line with what the Nassim is claiming. So that part of displacement of the vector along the curve was actually in line with whatever he was claiming. And I was shocked. And that happened after I sent the email to you, and I said, I don't care if he is right. I need that for the purpose of conversation. But you.
Lots of people have ground a parabolic mirror in their home. And when you're doing the grinding, you're getting down to optical wavelengths and better of smoothness of the blank and the mold, so to speak, the two pieces of glass. And the instructions they give you is to make sure you've always got the grinding material and the right lubricant between the two pieces of glass. If you're not careful, as you get them very, very smooth, you can run into the problem of them fusing together, which I think is close to the thing you're describing. So in the process of grinding a parabolic mirror, if you're not careful, as you get the two pieces of glass very, very smooth, you can get them locked together, and it becomes very difficult to separate them without creating damage. I wonder if this is the same effect. K2RAW.
Yes, you're talking about exactly the same effect, but you don't have to even look at that. The silly example of that would be two pieces of foil. And to exist.
Now, when I press two pieces of foil together between two rollers, the foil themselves are usually made out of fairly soft together. Are we seeing this effect, or are we just seeing a molding action? I don't know how you separate one from the other. Go ahead.
No. You're not putting them on the press. You're just putting one on the top of the other. Now, all of a sudden, you see that they stick. Now, you can also observe the water when it's all the way to the top of the container and it's curving and doing shit.
Yeah, that's called the local, what is it called, skin effect, or I forget what it's called. Various fluids have different amounts of that. Mercury behaves one way, water behaves another way.
Surface tension.
That's the right word, surface tension. So each fluid has its own particular surface tension, the way molecules on the surface behave compared to the molecules in the bulk of the material. And so the way you can make water go above the top of the glass, there are certain other kinds of fluids where you can't do that. So not all fluids do that.
Talking about that, radical statement. The energy comes from somewhere. The untapped energy comes from converting mass into atomic energy. The mass in the gas in the cans of, let's say, 100 of K of generator is going to contain, let's say, oxygen 01. The spark makes it magnetic for the moment because it opens the aperture of the atom and polarizes them all in the same direction. Now, the universe that is always feeding these atoms can easily, based on the Nazim theory, flow through them because it's dense and produce the local magnetic field. And then again, coming back to what I said, electron absorbs photons when they decelerate and emit photons when they, electron absorbs photon when they accelerate and emit photons when they decelerate. Back to you.
I think you're using the word accelerate, meaning excited to a higher energy level. If the electrons around a nucleus absorb the right number of photons of energy so that they get excited to a higher orbit.
Yeah, but we're talking also about changing the volume.
Okay. What you're saying is the excited molecule, while it's in the excited state, you're saying the molecule itself has a greater volume. I'll give you that. But in almost all situations, the space between individual molecules of a gas is huge compared to the size of the molecule itself.
Yeah, but when you increase the temperature, then increase the pressure in the closed container.
Yes, and where do you think that pressure is coming from? This is a discussion that Glenn and I had 2 weeks ago, and we agreed to disagree. When you raise the pressure, when you raise the temperature in a fixed container, PV equals NRT tells you how much the pressure increases.
But what I was trying to say, and I might be not precise in wording us, English is my second language, what I'm trying to say is that when you convert photons into the massless energy, I mean mass, containing mass energy, so the photon is hitting something, then we're talking about the mechanical impact, then we're talking about the creation of temperature, the same what we had with HARP system. Then we're talking about changing the mass in the closed containers. Back to you.
I don't agree. We're mixing two phenomena here. Temperature is average translational speed of the individual atoms or molecules. Temperature is speed. Excitation to a higher energy level is not necessarily an increase in temperature.
Do you have a proof for that? Can you support it?
When a gas laser is being, the lacing material is being excited, I could be cooling the container that contains the lacing material. I could cool that gas at the same time as I'm getting lacing action. They're independent.
What would Glenn would say about it, then?
Yeah, Glenn did say he has to leave us. He's got to work tomorrow. I've got to work tomorrow. But I know that you can cool the gas inside of a gaseous laser, and you can still get lacing action. So I think the excitation, which raises the electrons to a higher energy level, is not necessarily an increase in temperature. I don't have to make the molecules translate more with a higher speed in order to get lacing. That's not where the lacing action is coming from.
Okay, so I don't understand. Based on that, what I've heard from Glenn, we're talking about the expanding factor when the energy is absorbed. Also, we mechanically, we create the mechanical impact of the energy. Let's put it this way. You have two magnets, and you have, you increase rapidly the magnetic field of one of them. The repelling will actually create the magnetic, the mechanical action. The mechanical action could be with consequences. What kind of consequences are we dealing with? Do you understand what I'm saying?
I hear the words, but I'm not getting the concept. No, I don't understand that one.
Okay, you have one electromagnet, you have a magnet, and they are repeating themselves. Okay, now you increase the magnetic field of one of the magnets that would be electromagnet. Now you see the mechanical reaction of another magnet. There was work that was done to push that magnet further up. Back to you.
Okay, I can have a steady state neodymium magnet and an electromagnet, and I have north facing north, and there's a force of repulsion between them, and I'm measuring that force. And now I increase the field from the electromagnet in the same direction, I make it stronger. The force between the two magnets now increased. Is there any magic in that?
No, it is not. But in the micro level, we're dealing about the upper magnet mechanically or being moved up. Now, we're talking about the friction of the air, surrounding air, along that magnet. We're talking about temperature and to exchange.
I say that's not temperature. If I have the two magnets on a plastic rod, the lower one is an electromagnet, the upper one is a neodymium ring magnet.
So you say there is no friction between air molecules and the magnet. So let's put this this way. You have a tube, and you have a magnet, neodymium magnet, very, very tightly in that tube, and at the bottom, you have the electromagnet. Now, you have a friction because you increase the magnetic field from the bottom. Is that the friction and the temperature? Does that constitute the same with the micro particles of air and to exhale?
Okay, you didn't let me finish. I've got two magnets. The north poles are facing each other. One of them is freely floating above the other on a plastic rod. the lower magnet is an electromagnet. I pour more current into the lower electromagnet. I make the magnetic field stronger. The force of repulsion increases. The floating electromagnetic moves up to a higher altitude. It has a certain amount of mass. It has a certain amount of gravity acting on it. It's now at a higher potential energy state because it's higher up. I've increased its potential energy because it's at a higher altitude. Where did the energy come from? I applied that energy to the lower electromagnet. The lower electromagnet has a certain amount of inductance. The amount of energy that's stored in that lower electromagnet is 1/2 Li squared in joules. I increased that current. The I got bigger. I squared got bigger. I poured more energy into the lower electromagnet. The upper magnet got moved up, and I think I could account for all of the energy of that system. A little bit of air friction, that's minor. The majority of the energy that's in that upper magnet that's now floating at a higher altitude is because it is further away from the bench. I have increased, by way of gravity and distance, I've increased its potential energy. I think I could do that experiment very carefully, and I don't think there would be any missing energy in that experiment. But the majority of the energy is the altitude of the magnet with the stronger field. N2XJN, K2RIW.
Okay. So I understood from that, that very carefully doing that, there is the minimum close to zero of heat created. But doing it rapidly, that means rapid change, creates more friction. The more change, the temperature raises. But then, if we have that tube that I was talking about, and then we have a tightly magnet, upper magnet in the tube, and from the bottom we have the electromagnet, and then we increase the magnetic field from the electromagnet, that we have a temperature. So, at the same token, we could say that the temperature is almost always noticeable, the temperature change, just because of the energy. I'm not saying that we don't have the losses. I'm talking about it looks like there is a proof that the increase of energy creates a temperature raise. That's what I have a problem with it. Maybe I'm wrong. I do exist.
Okay, if I understand you correctly, you've got a tightly fitting spherical, or you've got a quarter-sized magnet in a tight-fitting tube, and when you create a stronger magnetic field that pushes upward, the air above gets compressed, the air becomes warmer.
It's one of the things, but also the friction of the magnet that is sliding up by the walls of the tube that is that has a spacing of, let's say, 1 micrometer or 0.5 micrometer. Back to you.
Let me go to the simpler experiment that I started talking about earlier. A fixed container, closed, contains a gas. I apply a flame to the outside of the container for a short period of time, and the container gets hotter. The pressure inside the container increases. Tell me why the pressure increases. Don't give the equation. Tell me why the pressure inside the container increases because I've heated that gas. K2RIW listening.
Because the energy is absorbed, that means electrons absorb photons, and they accelerate, they go to the higher orbit. So the volume is changing. And of course, this is a very much controversial statement. And by myself, I don't believe the 100%. Back to you.
K-E-Y, Dick.
Yeah, I don't believe that one at all. Mel recognized. You can't raise the electron orbit around an atom.